This podcast is sponsored by elspelio.com, importers of the best caving lights on the planet. Right now, you can save $20 when you buy any light at elspelio.com. And let me tell you something. I've taken two trips with my Elspelio Lunatic. That's really not enough. This thing needs to see some action, more action than I can give it. So I want you to try it. I'm prepared to lend you this incredible light for a few months so you can take it underground. No stipulations other than I want it to be used a lot. I want to hear about it too so I can fill people in, and then I want it back. And here's the great thing. Once I get it back, I'll announce that I have it back, and then I'll loan it to somebody else. And we'll just keep doing this as long as Elspelio wants to be involved. Here's the deal. I've got another Elspelio that's more than good enough for what I need. The Lunatic is something that deserves to go on so many more trips than this toddler dad and 30-something professional has time to organize. So if you think you can put it through its paces, I want to hear from you. My email address is alpineproductions@gmail.com. Alpineproductions, all one word, @gmail.com. That's my personal email address. I want you to pitch me on why you deserve to use my Elspelio Lunatic for a few months. I want to know why you want it, where you'll take it, and I want your assurance that I'll get it back and that you'll share with me what you did with it, pictures, everything. Now, I know things happen. What if it breaks? What if it gets lost? That kind of thing. I'm hoping that won't happen. I'm taking it on faith that you'll be responsible with it. And I'm also confident after having used it myself that it won't break. It's pretty tough. So if you want it, again, shoot me an email. Don't write me a novel. Try to keep it short and sweet, maybe a couple paragraphs. Why do you want it? Where will you take it? And make me confident I'll get it back. My Elspelio Lunatic could be yours for a little while. Email me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. Or again, if you want to own one yourself, go to elspelio.com. Use the promo code podcast at checkout to save $20 on any light. I'll put a link in the description of this episode. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm Matt Pelser, your host. This marks 5 years. 5 years of the Caving Podcast. It's insane. I started this thing in July of 2016. Just as a, I'll try this out. And it has exploded into quite a thing for the caving community. And I couldn't be prouder of that. Here's where I am now. I want this podcast to be a benefit to the caving community. I want it to be an outreach tool. And so far, we've done that. I've talked with a lot of people who have gotten into caving and done it the right way. NSS involvement, safety, proper gear, that kind of thing, because of the podcast. And I am so glad to be marking this anniversary with this episode, Seth Parker. And I want to thank Matt Bowers from the Western Region Spelio Ed and what would have been this year's convention for hooking me up with Seth. And I want to thank Seth again for agreeing to talk to me. He's a busy guy. We'll get to more on Seth in just a little bit. But let's talk about that Western Region Spelio Ed. So this is an in-person and virtual event, kind of a hybrid event, happening at the end of this month, July 25th through the 30th, in Weed, California, where the 2021 convention would have been, were it not virtualized. And honestly, a lot is still happening, as is the NSS virtual convention. I mean, that's still going on. If you're registered for that, great. But the Western Region Spelio Ed is going to be viewable on YouTube. And I'll link you to the Western Region Spelio Ed website in the description of this podcast. You can look it over and find out everything you need to know. And I'll also speed you to the registration website in case you do want to be there. There are lots of COVID protocols, so if you're concerned about that, they've got that all figured out. And there are just so many great workshops and field trips that are planned. Cave photography, geology, sketching, self-rescue. It's really kind of going to be a lot of what the convention would have been. And again, the convention's still happening. It's just on officially on a virtual basis at this point. So again, I'll link you in the description of this podcast, but I'll go ahead and say the URL now. It's wr2021.nsswest.org. wr2021.nsswest.org. But that's hard to remember. Again, link in the description. Matt, I hope I did that justice. What have I been up to? Not much. Answer is not much. My birthday's coming up soon. I was trying to put a trip together for my birthday weekend. It didn't end up working out. If you were one of the people that I texted about that, I'm I'm really sorry, because it was like I was texting a few people one day when I thought it was going to happen, and then hours later, it wasn't happening. A key person dropped out. So that weekend is on life support. I don't think it's going to make it. But I know that the CIG and the Windy City Grotto are doing a kind of a joint trip to some caves in southern Indiana. I might jump on that if they'll let me. Or, I don't know, maybe I'll just go hiking, backpacking, whatever. Try to get outside on my birthday weekend. I will say this, though. I am excited for Indiana Cave Capers. I will be at Indiana Cave Capers, which is the first full weekend in August. So it's August 6th, 7th, and 8th. And you can register for that when you arrive. I don't know if they've got the pre-registration up yet. No, not yet. But it's happening at the Crawford County Fairgrounds, just south of Marengo, Indiana. I assure you, you'll be able to register if you show up. If you've ever put on a caving event, you know what I'm talking about. So I'd love to hang out. Come to Indiana Cave Capers first full weekend in August. All right, enough about me. Seth Parker was an incredible guest. He works for NASA. We tried not to talk too much about that. You know, NASA has some protocols on what you can and can't talk about. I completely understand that, but there was a lot I wanted to talk about. So we got a little bit of it in there. He's also done some really impressive research on iron caves in Brazil. And he was part of a team that designed an experiment that is, I think, destined for the International Space Station, if it's not already up there, that they had to test out on the Vomit Comet. So we talked about him going on the parabolic flights and experiencing weightlessness and all that. Not caving related. Yeah, sure. But still pretty cool, right? So here is my conversation with California-based caver Seth Parker. Can I ask this? This is a dumb question. I'm sure you've been asked this before. Are you going to be the first person to go caving on the moon?
I would like to. I mean, so it's actually really fun when you look through Art Palmer's cave geology book, right? One of the final pages, there's this picture of an astronaut silhouetted inside of a lunar lava tube. And I remember looking through that in grad school and being like, that's fantastic. I want that to be me. And so, you know, fingers crossed, I did apply for the astronaut program. I have not heard back yet. But, you know, the people who are in charge of that make good decisions, and I'm sure they're going to pick the best qualified candidates. But I'm a little bit biased, and I think I would make a pretty good lunar caver.
Well, I mean, how many other cavers are working where you work? I mean, you seem like a shoo-in.
I mean, I would think that too, but, you know.
Because you can't just start caving, especially if you're on the moon. I mean, I'm sure that training would involve caves on Earth, but...
Yeah, I think a decent amount of the, at least from what I've seen of some of the European Space Agency and NASA cave, astronaut training involves some actual cave exploration. But I think with someone, you know, I've got a background going back to grad school doing caving stuff. So I think I've got a pretty decent background and background on it. So again, you know, I'm a little bit biased, but I think it seems like you should send a caver there to do it. But, you know, I'm sure they're going to pick like the best people they can to do the job.
Well, we're going to get to a little bit of your professional life. We don't want to spend too much time there. But really, I mean, I want to know about the genesis of your caving life. Like, where did that start? How did that start?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of funny. So my background's kind of like a little bit unique, I guess. I actually grew up in Tanzania.
Really?
Yeah, so my mom's a wildlife veterinarian. So I was originally born in Gainesville, Florida. She was working on the Panther Project down in Gainesville, in Everglades. And then she got a job to move to Tanzania to be the head veterinarian of Serengeti National Parks. And so, you know, picked up the family, me, my dad, my mom moved out there. Was out there for about 2 years, and she had my sister. And so, you know, classic Americana, you know, growing up on out in the Serengeti. There's actually pictures of me. You know, my job when we go out in the bush was to pick the ticks off the lions. That was Seth's job.
Wow. Whoa. Yes. Wait a second. That's pretty awesome.
Yes,
it's harrowing.
Five, you know, picking ticks off the line, putting them into falcon tubes to collect them for, you know, future analysis. I don't know if they were actually used for anything, but I felt like I was contributing, you know?
Well, like, did you dart them first? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to.
Well,
yeah.
No.
My mom used like an air rifle with, you know, some sort of ketamine or tranquilizer in the dart, and then we'd knock the lions out. We'd go, and then she'd take blood samples, hair samples, you know, fecal samples, and I would get little tick samples. So. again, you know, classic American upbringing, right? And I don't actually know what the you know, how many karst features are out in, you know, out in East Africa. I'm sure there are some, but I do remember it's actually not funny. My dad reading to me like Huckleberry Finn. It was the Huckleberry Finn or one of those books in that genre. And there's a period of that when they actually hang out in a cave for a little bit.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that from being a little kid. I think they're hiding out from bandits or something like that. I can find the book here later for you. But yeah, so that was kind of the first, like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then ended up moving back to the States later on in the mid-90s, late 90s. And then went on, you know, tour caves, show caves kind of stuff a few times. Didn't actually get into actual, I guess, you know, quote, real caving, right? wild caving until grad school. And you know, for everyone, you know, out there listening, I think my trajectory just really shows how important it is to follow up on emails, right? So I was in an undergrad in at Juniata College out in central Pennsylvania, and I had got an internship working with this professor, Dr. Chris Grant, doing stream reclamation. And so the idea is that streams are, you know, really windy, really weavy, and when we cut down all the trees, they become more windy and more weavy, right? And so what they used to do out here in Los Angeles, it was put in, you know, they'd cement them, put in cement, hold them in place. But that kind of evolved over time to, like, hey, let's plant some plants around the rivers to kind of hold them in place with roots and stuff like that. And so what they'd do is they'd plant multiflora rose, which is like an invasive plant. So, like, not great, but getting closer. And then what they end up doing now is you go through and you plant native trees and grasses and things that are actually you'd find in, you know, in rural Pennsylvania or in you know, Wisconsin, around the rivers to kind of make that riparian buffer zone. And so I had agreed to do this, you know, signed up, got this job to do this. And then the next day, another professor is like, hey, do you want to come and work in my lab this summer doing genomics on these microbes? And I'd like, that'd be great, but I've already said yes to this other guy. I can't really jump ship on him. But my best friend, Nick, do you want to do this job? Like, do this, you know, position, you can publish all this stuff. He's like, he jumped on it. Then he actually went to this conference in Philadelphia, came back. He's like, man, I just saw this crazy caver. She works for NASA. She rappels down buildings. She's fantastic. Her name's, you know, Hazel Barton. You should totally just try and work in her lab. And I'm like, yeah, I'll just email her and ask her to work in her lab. And about 2 weeks later, I was like, dear Dr. Barton, you're really cool. Can I come work in your lab? And her response was something, I wish I had the email somewhere, but it was something like, hey, we're kind of full right now, but, you know, send me a letter and a CV and some recommendation letters, so I'll get back to you. And I didn't hear anything for like 2-3 months. I was like, well, that's a no. So, you know, I started applying for other places. And I got this job to go down to do an internship in Baltimore doing like protein crystallography. And I was like, that sounds cool, but I'd much rather be in, you know, this cave microbiology lab. So I sent her one more email. I was like, hey, Dr. Barton, can I get a heads up, yes, no, on that opportunity? I haven't heard back from you. And then about 2 hours later, this email was yes. I was like, all right, I guess that sounds like a yes.
Short and sweet. Okay.
Short and sweet. So I think it turned out she was actually in, I think she was in China doing caving. So she was actually underground for a large portion of that 2 month period. So I, you know, drove out there and did basically my first actual cave work was working with Hazel Barton in Northern Kentucky University in 2010.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so, I mean, did the bug bite you then, or did that come later, or have you really done a whole ton of caving?
No, that was the first actual like caving I've done. I mean, I've done, you know, like Luray Caverns and, you know, some walkthrough caverns like that, but nothing really wild and actually, you know, being in a cave proper, I would say. And so that internship involved going down to a cave in Southern Kentucky and collecting some of this mat for this sediment from the ceiling, and then looking through that and analyzing for, you know, who's growing here and what kind of properties they have. And I think the project I had at that time was looking at plasticizers, so microbes that can like digest and break down plastics. And it was my first time actually being, you know, in a cave in an environment like that doing field work. And it was just such a wonderful, kind of exciting feeling to be, you know, on the edge of the edge of science, which is always a really kind of cool feeling to be, but also being in such a, you know, extreme environment. That's when it kind of, you know, awakened in me, I guess, the caver.
So breaking down plastics, I mean, 2010 is a little too recently to be able to apply anything like that. But I do feel like I see things because I follow a lot of science news. I do feel like I see things where that's a hot research topic, finding microbes that'll break down plastics because of all the plastics that we have out there.
Oh, completely, completely. I don't know if anything came from my work that summer. But the interesting thing about caves and microbes in caves is that when you put microbes in really stressed environments, they're forced to do things they wouldn't necessarily do. And what I mean by that is if you have a normal microbe, it can, you know, metabolize glucose or something really high energy carbon source. But in caves, there's this effect where you get farther you get from the sun, the more basic the food sources become, right? Mm. So they become, you know, short chain fatty acids, like you know, one or two carbon organics, basically. So not as much energy is involved there. And so what you can do then as a microbe is either you can work with your neighbors, right, to break down large components, and each of you trade off in the consortium and break down different components of like larger molecules, or you can kill your neighbor, right, and take their stuff. it's kind of the games down there, right? And so because these microbes are kind of forced to the edge of, you know, edges of metabolism, edges of physiology, what they can do, they're forced to jump through hoops to do kind of bizarre things. And one of the things we're looking at is how well can microbes actually, like, you know, break down these compounds we find in plastics. And so I think, I mean, I'm not sure where we are with that current research, but there are definitely applications for it when we you know, do track down the bugs that can do it.
And so what came after that? I mean, can you describe how or whether or not you wanted to go back and what form that took?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so at the time, Hazel Barton was working at Northern Kentucky University, which doesn't really have a master's, doesn't have like a graduate program. And so this would have been my sophomore junior summer. Went back to college, you know, junior year, started thinking about graduate programs and knowing I wanted to do a PhD in microbiology and thinking it would be really awesome to be able to do a PhD doing the work similar to what I was doing in my internship at Hazel. Doing, you know, extremophile microbiology in caves. Unfortunately, Hazel was working at Northern Kentucky University at the time, which didn't have a PhD program. And so I started getting, you know, letters together, started getting applications together, shot Hazel an email. I was like, hey, can I get a letter of recommendation from you to go to graduate school? And she's like, yeah, for sure. No problem. Let me know where you want me to send it. And then about 2 weeks later, I get this email from her saying, hey, you know, I'm writing you these letters, but, you know, are you interested to come work with me on some projects? And I'm like, well, what kind of projects do you have in mind? And I was like, I thought you were at, at Northern Kentucky still. And then the next email got, I think actually I have this saved somewhere. I think the email read something like, Seth, I'm recruiting you to be a PhD student to work in my lab to study iron caves in the Amazon. Are you interested? And I'm like, yes, I am.
Okay.
And so then that completely changed the trajectory of where I was applying to, and ended up just, you know, pulling the other applications and just going to work with Hazel in the University of Akron.
And, you know, I hear that, and knowing where you are, I think iron caves, I think possible astronaut, and then I think Mars. Okay, we don't have to go there, but this is just where my head is.
Well, right. I mean, so even if, you know, I don't make it through the candidate program, I think the things we see in caves are really kind of special in a sense that we can kind of take what we see there and what kind of microbes live in certain locations and kind of apply those to other, you know, solar bodies other than the Earth, mm-hmm. including Mars. We get to this later probably in the conversation, but I don't think we'd have the same exact environment as we see in the Brazilian iron caves as we do in possible like lava tubes on Mars. But there are some similarities there that I think should be worked out here in the near future.
So what did you find in Brazil then?
Brazil is pretty fantastic. So I think one of the coolest parts about Brazil that most people don't really know about is that they actually have a really, really good environmental law, which you don't really tend to think about. And what's really fantastic about that is I think back in the mid-90s, they started passing all of these laws about protecting caves, essentially. And so if you're going to do any kind of digging or mining or, you know, building anything on you know, fresh, you know, pristine ground, you actually have to do a cave survey to look for caves. And to do this, you actually have to hire a third party to come in and actually make sure that, you know, there's no caves in the area that you're going to damage. And then there's a whole ranking system of quality of cave and uniqueness of cave. And depending on how unique and special that cave is, you have to get some sort of permit to damage it, or you have to can't touch it at all. And so because of this, lots of the iron mining companies in Brazil have actually helped find a lot of these iron caves in Brazil, which is pretty fantastic. And so when I say iron caves, I don't actually mean, you know, caves in limestone that have some iron in them. In Brazil, we're finding, you know, I think it's upwards of 3,500 caves so far that are forming in iron rock.
Wow.
So the background of that, the geology of that is actually also pretty fantastic. So the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago. The atmosphere was, you know, much, much different than today. There's lots of CO2, lots of methane, not oxidative at all, right? And then about 2.5 billion years ago, these cyanobacteria popped up and started polluting the atmosphere with oxygen, right? Taking in sunlight, is just jerks, right? Polluting the world with oxygen, ruining it for all those bacteria out there, all those anaerobes, producing all this oxygen, and which then changed, obviously, what could live at the surface, but that had a larger effect on the oceans of the world, right? So at the time, you had all of this iron too. So there's a number of types of iron. You get FeO, Fe3, and Fe2. And the most ones we're common with are Fe3, which is like the rust you see on cars. It's when iron oxidizes. It's that kind of, you know, orange, reddish material. And Fe2 is actually water soluble. And so what happened during these microbes polluting the atmosphere, that's called the Great Oxidation Event. And essentially, they produced so much oxygen that it interacted with all of this Fe2, all this iron 2 solubilized in the world's oceans. This iron 2 then rusted out and fell to the floor of the oceans. So you can imagine all the world's oceans rusting. And so you get a layer of rust, and then you get some sand wash onto it, then some rust, and a layer of sand wash onto it. And in the end, you get these rocks that are called banded iron formations. So then there are layers of laminae of iron, silica, iron, silica, iron, silica, iron, silica. Those rocks, these sediments, then got compressed, subducted, metamorphized a little bit, and then they've started popping up to the surface in the last, you know, 100 million years. And these rocks are known as banded iron formations. And it's where we get the majority of our iron mined, comes from these formations. And what's kind of phenomenal about this is that Brazil has two deposits of, I believe, higher than 60% iron ore per weight. But these iron banded iron formations, these, you know, alternating layers of iron silica produced by these microbes, you know, 2.5 billion years ago, these tend to be around 30% iron by weight. And so something's happening to these deposits to have them become more enriched. And there are some geologic ways this happens, where you get thermal heating, which then removes the silica and kind of condenses the iron into these blobs. But the bizarre thing about Brazil is we find the best iron ore deposits surrounding these caves, which is quite fantastic. And so if you look at the maps of these mining sites, they've got these really bizarre shapes. And a lot of this shape is them chasing the metal, but also a lot of it is them dodging the caves because they're by law not allowed to damage these caves. And so if you walk along, if you get, you know, if you're in Brazil, you get to one of these caves or one of these mine sites, there's lots of security. They're very catchy about their mines down there. But really cool satellite photos, you can actually see where these caves are, and you can see the mines basically wiggling as close as they can to the caves without damaging them by law, which is pretty cool. One of the interesting things about these caves is that, you know, most people haven't heard of iron caves. You know, you go to conferences, you talk to, you know, even like, you know, cave experts, and they're like, wait, you know, you mean that there's like iron rich karst, right? It's like, no, it's not iron. Well, technically it's karst, right? But it's not iron-rich limestone. It's actual iron caves where the stuff has been removed from the inside of the rock, the iron rock, to make the caves, right? And so it's not like there's some soluble body that's been removed. It's the rock itself that is somehow solubilizing. And so one of the reasons these caves are not talked about very much is that if you go to Brazil to go caving, you know, you're not going to spend your time, you know, going to one of these caves because they're really short. They're really small. And they tend to be only about 30 meters in length on average, and, you know, about, you know, chest height, a little taller, at least at the entrances. And so, you know, if you're going to go to Brazil, you're going to go to one of these. You know, they've got some fantastic silica caves. Up in the north, they've got caves along the Venezuelan border, these kind of Tapui caves, right? So just beautiful, you know, 1,000-meter-long caves, but, like, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to write home about a little mud pit you found. And so it was actually really funny when one of the times I was down there, I was working with some of the field researchers, and this one girl, we're at this bar after one field day, and she's like, why do you come here? Why do you come to my country? He's like, well, for your really, really cool cave. She's like, no, this is ridiculous. You live in North America. You have all of Tag. You've got Tennessee, Alabama, you know, Georgia, all of these amazing deep limestone caves. Why do you come to these stupid little caves? And so it's funny because some of the researchers there don't even appreciate how unique and special these systems are. And that's one of the reasons I think that me and Hazel basically got to be some of the first people who worked on these systems from a microbiology context, because they're just very unknown, untalked about.
Because they're so close to the surface. I don't know. It would seem to me, and I'm not a scientist, but it would seem to me that the biodiversity that close to the surface, you know, 30 meters from the entrance, would still be a little great, which would kind of be an obstacle for you to study anything unique down there.
Right. Well, so some of the stuff we're kind of working on is a publication coming out here shortly, so I can't tap into too many of the details.
Sure.
But from a more of a macro scale, yes and no, right? So these landscapes, they look like almost like lava flows, in the sense that, like, you get this, the surface of this rock is this rock called Kanga. So essentially, imagine you get your mountain of your banded iron formation. And then on top of that, you get this anywhere from like half a meter up to like max 6 meters. But they tend to be about 2 meters in depth of this blanket that covers the rock in this cap. And this rock is composed of clasts, of chunks of the underlying banded iron formation, basically glued into this matrix of hematite, or sorry, into goethite. And so you get these really kind of hard, insoluble silica, iron, you know, banded iron formation chunks glued together in a more soluble, more of a, I guess, not so crystalline, amorphic iron cap. And so lots of these caves tend to form at that boundary between this amorphic iron cap and this more crystalline iron cap. And the thing is, like, you see a lot of diversity in these caves because there's not that many other, sounds weird, but like, you know, lots of these places are on this basically massive escarpment, right? And so there's not that many places for organisms to be, if that makes sense. Hmm. And there's not that much access into sediment or into dirt around the tops of these iron places, right? So it is like one of the only environments for refuge for some of these microbes. Some of these large bugs, excuse me.
Sure.
And we're actually finding, I think that these caves in Brazil have something like, I want to say it's 100, 150 organisms, actual bugs, that are unique only to these cave systems. So despite seeming to be really, really short, we do see organisms that are adapting to live in these cave environments, which is pretty phenomenal. Because everyone talks about, oh, you know, you're still in that twilight zone, you're still in like the 30-meter twilight zone or 10-meter twilight zone. But we're seeing organisms, you know, choosing to live in those places and then adapting to become, cave adapted in those locations.
Ah, man. So even though they're short, they do still form in a way that is, I don't know, kind of similar to what we know to be limestone caves, because it's water soluble.
So water insoluble.
It's water insoluble. So what's forming the cavity then?
That's the question for the last 200 years. Is like, how are these caves forming? You know, what's happened? And the answer for the last 200 years is, it's geology. It's some weird geologic fluke. There's some soluble body that's coming out. But that sounds kind of a cop-out, right? Like, so what's actually driving this cave formation? There has to be some better answer than that. And some of our research is actually showing the presence of iron-reducing microbes, right? And so you can think of, you know, you and me, we both breathe oxygen, right? We breathe oxygen and we respire oxygen. These microbes, they respire iron. Right. And so, which is wild. Right. And so the idea is, when we breathe oxygen, we use oxygen as it's called our terminal electron acceptor. Right. And so inside of our cells, we've got a little mitochondria, a little powerhouse of the cell. Right. Uh-huh. And we feed them oxygen. They take, glucose or other food we eat. They break down those carbon, and then they dump those little electrons onto oxygen. Right. That becomes CO2 we breathe out. So those little mitochondria used to be free living cells, 1.5 billion years ago or whatever, right? And so those little mitochondria cells do the same exact thing as these cave microbes, except instead of breathing or respiring oxygen, they use iron. which is fantastic. So these microbes are breaking down organic carbon, dumping those electrons onto iron, taking iron 3, which is this hard chunk of iron block, and dissolve it into iron 2, which is water soluble. And the idea is then you get water movement through this rock. It picks up that solubilized iron 2 and washes it away.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the takeaway, this end project, is this cavity is forming in these rocks, basically being these caves. And so we're finding some interesting microbes like living in these caves. They're doing these processes.
So it's all thanks to the microbes. It is.
I mean, as a microbiologist, I'm a little bit biased. And I think most things are actually, you know, caused by and mitigated and mediated by microbial activity.
Sure.
But we're pretty confident that the majority of what we're seeing in these caves is happening from these microbial activities.
Wow.
I mean, from looking at it from a geologic perspective, there's no other answer that can explain why you would get this kind of solubilization rates and these sort of formations occurring. Like even looking, when you go to these caves and you look at the amount of iron present in these systems, there's a lot of iron too present, right, in water. And if you remember from earlier in our conversation, we're talking about the great oxidation event, right? And when you have iron too and you expose it to oxygen, it should rust out, right? It should basically just, you know, fall away. But we're seeing high levels of iron too in these systems, and which is also another demonstration of these microbes, you know, metabolizing and utilizing this iron as their electron acceptor and solubilizing it away.
Man, it's such a trip, man. That is fascinating. Okay, let me shift gears here a little bit. Have you been on survey trips?
I've been on a few survey trips, not enough.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Where at?
So I did some surveying down in West Virginia. It's called Poor Farm Cave, and mm-hmm. So it was part of the Cleveland Grottoes. Shout out to Cleveland Grotto.
Yeah.
Part of the Cleveland Grottoes. A few years back, they're working on surveying a cave down there. So I did I think two or three trips down there surveying. I've been involved in some LIDAR cave mapping out in Big Bat Cave in Kentucky.
Yeah, Ken Bailey's doing that. I interviewed him about that. It's so cool.
Yeah, no, I was on one of the survey teams back in 2016, and I would recommend if anybody, you know, looking for something to do, it's a fun weekend. Basically, you work on shifts, and it just goes nonstop, just, you know, shooting LIDAR. So that was a pretty cool experience. I'm trying to get on do some more surveying. California is a little bit tight on caves, so not as many caves as you know, Southeast. But yeah, I'm trying to work on that. So if anyone wants a microbiologist or a surveyor, I know a guy. You know,
where else have you been? I mean, okay, there's got to be other places then on your list. Like, have you been invited to Lechuguilla?
I have not yet, but again, I do know a microbiologist who would love to go to Lechuguilla. So, I mean, Lech is also just really phenomenal from the microbiology perspective.
Yeah,
won't get too deep into it, but we're finding that the microbes there are also helping produce sulfuric acid, which is increasing and basically driving the cave formation process in the deep subsurface, which is phenomenal. Yeah. And again, I think it's just so fantastic that all these processes we're finding on large scales are driven by microbes, by bacteria. And, you know, 10, 15, 20, you know, 30 years ago, people, you know, wouldn't, you know, I think a little longer than that, maybe 40 years ago, you know, you couldn't convince people of that. You know, like these are processes that, you know, are large scale processes that have to be driven by, you know, by geologic. So obviously geology is a large component in this, right? But I think it's just fantastic. We're finding more and more ways that microbes are actually shaping the world around us in, you know, multiple ways, starting with the, you know, great oxidation event and going through now playing into, you know, the iron cycle in Brazil and things like that.
It's a team effort. Yeah. There's geology and then there's biology.
Exactly. And I think not enough people, I think, appreciate how much of a role the biology plays in speeding up these processes.
Yeah. Even when it comes to limestone caves, are you finding?
Right. So that kind of depends on limestone cave.
Sure.
So we're finding microbes in, you know, obviously in microbes are everywhere. You know, our planet's just covered and filthy in them. And so we're finding them throughout, you know, lots and lots of places. But for microbes to actually help in the formation of limestone caves, that takes a little more special kind of situation. And so this is what we're seeing in Lechuguilla and in some other systems that are fed by, basically you get sulfide rich water upflowing up. And so the microbes then can interact with that, metabolize that, and produce hydrogen sulfide. Mm. And so in situations like that, they can help increase the cave rate. But in other caves, we're also seeing lots of minerals forming. There's some work up here in California in some of the lava tubes. We're looking at biomineralization. And so we're finding all of these funky minerals that are being, we think, being formed by microbes. And this is interesting because, one, it's like you're finding some really bizarre things that microbes are forming. But also it's kind of cool because they could be used as biomarkers. So if you go, oh, we find this type of bizarre mineral, this could be produced by X microbe or Y microbe in this process. And so if you see this mineral, you could safely say, you know, this is the safest bet that if we see this mineral in this location, it's probably produced by a microbe.
Again, team effort. It's so cool. So you're volunteering for the 2021 NSS convention, or at least you were. We knew that you were when it was an in-person event. Now we know that it's going to be a virtual event. What's your involvement?
Right. So I'm not totally sure at this point what's going to happen with that. I think there's sure. there's a lot. Everything's in flux. There's apparently there's a pandemic going on.
Oh yeah, really?
I mean, I've only seen the inside of my room for the last year and a half, so I'm not sure what's happening outside. But supposedly there's a pandemic going on. Originally I was supposed to be, I think I was talking with one of the directors and was going to help. So we're going to try and set the Guinness World Record for the largest papier-mâché volcano. So that's not super academic. And I think that might be postponed until until we do actually NSS in person next time. And I think there was an opportunity for me to sit on a panel talking about just the role of caves in our solar system and locations for unique possible things outside of Earth. But at this point, I'm not totally sure. I do know that this coming, I think the NSS is now going to be the Western Regional, I believe. And I know they're holding a SpelioEd seminar during the convention that week. Apparently, it's still in Weed, and it's supposed to be a pretty cool program where they're going to show some of the pre-recorded NSS stuff actually at that during the program. They'll also be holding a few in-person workshops and social events for cavers from across the country. So I recommend anybody who can make it out there. They're still holding Western Regional. Should be a good time. There are also a number of lava beds out there. Lava Beds National Monument is pretty close to that. And there's been a number of different NASA groups doing work in those caves. One of the main ones is Braille, where they're using a robot to actually go through and can we use lava tubes as analogs for robotic exploration. So if you've got free time in the late summer, recommend coming out to that.
Can we talk a little bit about what we know or what we think we know about caves on other worlds? And I mean, I don't know. We could go wherever you want to go, but what do we know?
Yeah. So it's actually exciting. We don't know that much.
I would imagine.
Right. And so far what we're seeing are these things that look like caves based on entrances. And so what's so exciting about this is we've got, right now we've got an N of one of, solid rocky bodies we've explored caves with. Right. And we don't really know what to expect on these other systems. And what's so phenomenal about this is that when you look at, what makes caves microbes, as you all should think about now, next time you're in a cave, it's like, oh, is this a microbe? What kind of cave am I in? How are these microbes changing what I'm in? microbes drive it. We know geology drives it. But a major factor also in cave formation is gravity, right? And so when we think about that, because all of Earth has one standard gravity. But as we move out to different rocky bodies and even ice bodies in the solar system, we have different gravities, which enable different size passages to form and different size tubes to form. And I don't know the exact specs off the top of my head, but there's some just absolutely enormous possibilities on the moon of how big some of these cavities could be. Just based on, if you look at the geology, we know there's basaltic rock on the moon. We know there's lava flow, kind of recently, geologically speaking, on the moon. And, billion years, 1.5 billion years back, at least, not sooner. And we're pretty sure that we can see evidence of lava flows on the moon. And on the moon, we see these really bizarre kind of paths that almost look like what we would expect to see on Earth as pits along a lava tube. And so when you get a lava tube, you get a long sinuous passage that kind of hardens up as the rock, solidifies, then it can kind of cover over. And then as time goes on, after the rock is hardened, you get these basically chunks that fall through making skylights. And so on the moon and on Mars, we see these locations that look like skylights that look like they follow along certain paths. So we would assume that they might be lava tubes. But the thing is, no one's actually gone and looked there, right? And so we don't really know. The other interesting thing about Mars is it's not nearly as geologically active as the Earth is, right? That's why we have Olympus Mons, right? So if you look at Hawaii, there's a hot spot under the Pacific Plate. Pacific Plate moves over it, and you basically get this volcano that pops up over time. And you actually can look at how the plate's moving based on the shape of the Hawaiian Islands. And so imagine now if that plate hadn't been moving, if that plate was stationary, you get just a giant buildup of magma and lava. And so that's what happened on Olympus Mons on Mars. So we know there was a lot of, you know, volcanic activity occurring on Mars at one point. But the question is, do we see lava tubes there in the same way we see them here? And if there are lava tubes there, how are they different? Are they preserving certain minerals differently? Can they give us a snapshot back into time? Because, you know, again, there's not the same sort of geologic plate tectonic activity happening on Mars as on Earth. These lava tubes could potentially be kind of basically time capsules looking back, you know, much, much deeper into time than the caves on Earth can. And the same thing for the moon. But the thing is, we're only seeing structures from the surface, you know, from orbiting satellites that look like these structures. And so is this a hole? Yes, is it a hole, but does it lead to a cave system? Or is it just some sort of pit that forms from, you know, bizarre solubility? And we don't really know yet. But hopefully we're sending people up there soon to find out, people and robots. So,
indeed. Oh, how exciting. So I want to talk a little bit, and I know that there are some restrictions here, but I want to talk a little bit about your work and some of the unique things you've gotten to do through your work with NASA.
Oh, definitely. Well, again, I think that this comes back to the story of just, you know, following up on emails is so important, which sounds silly. but also if you go to conferences, you're academic or caving or just you're meeting people in general, don't be so shy, I guess. And what I mean by that is you go to these things and you see people sitting with their friends at tables and just like kind of talking amongst yourself, which is fun, which is good, has its place, but it's really important to, you know, make connections, make networking, because you never know what can come from that. And I think one of the best examples of this is I was at the American Society for Gravitational and Space Research conference, so ASGSR, in Denver back in 2019. And at all conferences, they always have the booths lined up with all the swag. You can get, you know, free backpacks, free pens, free shirts and whatnot. And I'm walking along just collecting my pens, collecting my, you know, free sunglasses. And there's a guy there sitting with this model of an airplane. And I'm like, hey, man, sorry, what do you do? And his response is like, oh, I do flight opportunities for NASA. And I'm just like, what does that mean? And he's like, well, yeah, so we're working on what we help do is help get people to be able to test their instrumentation and test their experiments on Earth under microgravity, you know, simulating microgravity prior to flying on the space station. So if you have any technology you're working on that you're trying to fly in space, you know, let me know. We can try and maybe get you, you know, maybe on a flight. And I'm like, well, that's really interesting because I'm actually working on an instrument right now that's designed to do DNA extraction from the space station, aboard the space station, or in low gravity environments.
Whoa.
Right, exactly. And so we had actually gone to Yellowstone earlier that year to test out this instrument in the field. And he's like, well, that's awesome. Well, here's my card. Shoot me an email. So, you know, that night at the conference, went home, you know, at the hotel room, and shot him an email, you know, right off the bat so I didn't forget. Then fast forward about a month and a half, you know, we're in like mid-January at this point, and I get an email from him, and he's like, you know, hey, hi, Seth, are you still interested in doing a parabolic flight? And I'm like, well, yes. and his response is like, well, one of the people who actually, one of the groups who actually purchased a seat on our flight had to cancel, and so there's an open seat if you are still interested. And my response is like, well, yes, I am still interested. And so basically because I had that, you know, that in passing conversation with this person at a booth at a conference, and I followed up with an email, we were offered a seat on one of these parabolic flights. And so, later last fall, our group, and another group from JPL actually shared a seat on a parabolic flight to test out our instrument.
Whoa. So what were you able to, what were you able to do?
Yeah. So, it's actually a really interesting process. So there's a lot of, it's actually really good. So there's a lot of safety precautions they go through to make sure whatever you're flying is, you know, safe to you, but also safe to the environment because you're, you know, inside a closed pressure container, you know, inside an airplane. Most don't really think about that. Right. So we had to make sure, you know, nothing would leak out, make sure all the parts are held down solid. But yeah, so we ended up sending, you know, shipping our stuff down there. We showed up and then we actually got 2 days of flights. And so essentially the way the Vomit Comet works, it's also known as like a parabolic flight, is that, you know, when you're driving and you go over a hump in the road, how you kind of feel your stomach come up, right?
The belly getters.
Yeah, exactly. Belly getters, right? Or on a roller coaster, if you're falling right, just the right feet, you know, right speed down, it feels like you're kind of falling a bit, like up, you know, or like on an express elevator. And so the idea is if you fall at the same speed of gravity, you won't feel like you're feeling gravity fall on you because everything will be moving and falling at the same speed. And the idea is if you take an airplane and you fly at the right angle downwards, you'll actually experience that same feeling. And so these are called parabolic flights and also known as vomit comets. but the part they don't tell you about this, we don't think about with this, is that it's called a parabolic flight because you have to fly in parabolas. So it's not just a down. You have to fly up and then down and up and then down and up and then down. So it is like a roller coaster, but it's a roller coaster you can't really get off of. And so that's why it's also, you know, again, referred to as the vomit comet. So I think, I don't know the exact stats on this, but I know on our flight personally, there was, I want to say there was like 20, 21 researchers. And I think about a quarter of the people, like 7 or 8 people actually puked.
And so, oh, no.
Right. But it's even better than that because, you know, it's the middle of COVID time. So you're wearing a face mask, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not great for them, but it's better for the rest of us because it kind of keeps it close to them body. But, if you look at the flight profile, it's kind of funny because like if we're going, then there's a pause and then we get back into the cycle. And that pause is because they had to come out with Clorox and then wipe down the ceiling because some droplets started flying around, sticking stuff. Yeah, it was wild. I do recommend that, you know, for those of you who will do this or get a chance to it, definitely do it, but also do what they recommend, follow their instructions. Cause I know we got 2 days of flights and on day one, I was pretty cocky and they say, you know, lay down with your head on the floor, look at the ceiling. But the problem is we're laying right next to my instrument, right? So I wanted to watch my machine to make sure it was going to be okay through this thing. And so I was staring at, head turned to the side for the first like 5 or 6 parabolas. And then it's like, oh wait, maybe that wasn't a great idea. And so the last 7 or 8 didn't feel great. So I did, proud to say, did not puke. It didn't take
Dramamine?
Yeah. So some of the people on the flight were taking little tabs of Dramamine. You can like stick them behind your ears. Lots of weird rituals people were doing. Some people were taking like smelling salts or doing smelling salts. And so by the end of the flight, it's a weird mix of like hot air, like hint of vomit and smelling salt in the airplanes. It's a really odd mixture. But yeah, so no Dramamine, just some ginger candy. And I was good to go. The other fun thing though, is as a civilian, you can buy seats on these flights. And basically I don't know the market pricing is like $7,000, something like that. But you get 1 day of 15 parabolas. For our research group, we got 2 days, 30 parabolas each. And so it was just, you know, always a lot.
Wow, that is a lot.
But the funny thing about that, though, is that when people started puking on our flight, it was right around parabola 17 or 18, right? And so I think that's why they cut it short for the commercial flights, because they cut it right before people start losing the lunch. I think it's kind of funny. Good planning on their part.
So that had to have been kind of fun. Did you get to like float? I mean, and you did.
It wasn't fun at all. It was actually kind of boring.
Really? Okay. Because, okay. You got me. I'm the most gullible person on the planet.
It was phenomenal. It was something out of a dream. Because it's also just not like a physical experience. It's also just like, it's all the senses, right? I mean, we already talked about, you know, smell and taste, right?
Yeah.
But as you come up the engines, basically you're laying on the floor, and there's a guy in the back of the bullhorn basically counting it down. And so he goes, you know, 1, 2, 3, pull. And then you feel the airplane pull upwards and you get about 1.82 G's of pressure on you. And then you hear, as you start kind of cresting over the parabola, you can hear the engines cycle down. And then the guy yells, you know, release. And then everything just starts floating off the ground. And it's wild. And so for the first, I guess, 45 parabolas, 50 parabolas of this. It was just so, what sounds silly, right? But it was just so intense on making sure we got this data, because, you know, this was a, you know, a free slot, and how often do you get a chance to like get this data, right? And so this helped move our instrument closer to spaceflight. And so it was just like, you're so focused in on like, must make sure this thing is going to work, must make sure the cameras are positioned right, that we get like all the right videos. And yeah, so for the first, you know, first day, and then half of the second day, it was just so focused on making sure it worked. I think some other groups had the right idea, where they only planned to use like 3 parabolas and the rest were just kind of hanging out. But I definitely, at the end, the last few got to just kind of float around, got to do the whole Superman fly thing. I think there's a picture somewhere of me doing like meditating upside down, sitting on the ceiling. You know, it was wild. It was like literally out of a dream.
So everything with the device, you got all the data that you needed?
Yeah, definitely. So we ended up getting the data we needed. Luckily, like, we had the cameras positioned in the right location. We showed the correct movement of the piston arms and the fluid retention. And yeah, it worked. It worked fantastic. And so this is just moving this device hopefully closer to being utilized on the space station, and then future Lunar Gateway, and hopefully on to Mars at some point.
Great. You got the NSS James G. Mitchell Award at the Montana Convention?
I did. Yes, I did. Thank you.
Yeah, and what was that on?
So that was on my Brazil cave research.
Oh, okay, which we've already covered. That's super cool, though.
I can definitely post point people in the direction of the previous papers we post on this. But also, we're coming out with a paper pretty soon here, which should be, I think, again, I'm biased, but I think it's pretty friggin' cool, and kind of changes how we think of this whole process. It's really exciting stuff.
The NSS, since we're such a small and close-knit national organization, I mean, as far as national organizations go, our membership is not that of a lot of others. And so we're all kind of, you know, caving and cavers are a close-knit group. What would you say to budding young cavers who might also have a science background or a science affinity, who might want to look at caving as an opportunity to study and then present their research through the NSS or maybe at NSS conventions?
But yeah, as you know, saying before, you know, networking is so, so important. And especially in organizations like the NSS, where it's a very small knit group community where, you know, everyone knows everyone essentially. And I know, I think that presenting research at NSS is such a like, fantastic location, because you get basically a bullhorn to, you know, show what you've done to almost everybody in the community. And it just gets out, the information gets out into the group so much faster. Yeah. So I would say anybody who's, you know, in NSS or doing, you know, cave research of any kind, I would recommend, you know, presenting your stuff at the NSS convention. It's just a great way to, well, one, get what you've done out, because you've done the science. It's good to, you know, actually have the science shared with people, but also then make connections for your future steps, whether that be in academia or going on, you know, unique cave trips where people need, you know, people with your skill sets.
Yeah, more doors will open. Aside from some of the possible future things that might be happening for you, what else in the caving world would you really like to do?
I want to get into more expedition caving.
Yeah.
So I'm working the way that way. So I've actually got my EMT certification about a year and a half ago. I'm taking NCRC here in about a week.
Good call.
And so working on that.
You're just doing a weekend, or are you doing the week long? You're doing the whole thing?
Week long up in Albany. So it should should be nice and warm. yeah. So it should be a good time. I'm trying to work on my sketching skills. And yeah, trying to basically build up my capabilities so I can get picked up on some cool trips here.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about science, but you got the bug. You're a caver, and this is always a silly question. What have you topped out at as far as like a lengthy trip?
Oh, really short.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds silly, but I really haven't had that many opportunities yet to do kind of long trips yet.
Yeah.
I don't know. So that sounds silly. So again, like, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, you went to Brazil to do caving for your PhD. That's so cool. It's like, I know, it was awesome. But like, the caves are really short, right? And so, I mean, it sounds funny, but they're kind of like hobbit hole sized in the sense that like, they're just like about the size of a hobbit hole. So I think it's something like 1 8-hour plane flight, another 2-hour plane flight, connecting flight, you know, 2-hour drive, followed by another 9-hour drive, 4-mile hike, and then you're in this little tiny cave, right? So it's just funny. So I mean, like, it's because of the science that makes it, you know, makes it powerful. But you know, it's like these long expeditions, but like expeditions to get to the cave and do the science, not necessarily to, you know, to do the whole mapping of the cave. Mm. I'd probably say, like, you mean like my longest duration underground or longest like actual cave trip?
Longest duration underground, I suppose.
I'm embarrassed to say it. No, it's going to be, I mean, on the order of like, I don't know, 9 hours, 10 hours, something like that.
Nothing. I mean, that's me. But then again, I'm not an expedition caver. You know, my longest trip was 10 or 11, I think, at this point. You know, the only reason I do this podcast is because I am a recreational caver, and I also have a background in radio. And so I am the guy, I guess. And so, I mean, I'm there with you on that. And that's nothing to sneeze at either.
Yeah, I know. It's just like, it's when you talk to me like, oh yeah, I've spent, you know, like 4 weeks underground, or, you know, 2 weeks underground or whatever. It's just like, that's awesome. Take me with you, you know?
Yeah. Well, you'll get there.
I'm working on it.
Especially if you get on one of those Lech trips.
I will see what I can do.
Well, I don't want to jinx it for you. Seth, this has been so cool. And I wish you all the best. And you're doing some really important, really, really exciting, cool work. And I can't wait to see what's coming for you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And you know, NSS is a small community. And if anyone has any questions, just reach out. Love to talk to everybody.
So cool. So cool. Thank you, Seth. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. And remember, Western Region Spelio Ed, happening in conjunction with the virtual 2021 NSS convention. Again, I'll link you to the event website in the description of this podcast, or you want to head straight to the registration. I'll put that link in there too. Thanks to our sponsors, past and present, Swago at swagogear.com, Organic Robot Designs, hit up the Etsy shop, or go to organicrobotdesigns.com. And of course, El Spelio, our current sponsor. Again, if you want to borrow my El Spelio lunatic, send me an email, alpineproductions@gmail.com. If you missed that at the beginning of the episode, you skipped through it, go back and check that out. I want to loan my El Spelio to you if you're going to take it to some cool places. Or if you want to buy an El Spelio, enter the promo code podcast and save $20 on any light at elspelio.com. All right, I think that's everything. Have a great July. Hope you're going to make it to the convention virtually or otherwise. And until next time, kill nothing but time.